8th. This is VOA 1 The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Jill Robbins. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
India is the world's biggest vaccine maker, and it is getting ready for the worldwide effort to contain the coronavirus crisis. India manufactures more than 60% of all vaccines sold across the world. While its $40 billion drug industry is not yet involved in the production of the expensive Pfizer Incorporated and Moderna shots, the country will play an important job in immunizing much of the world. Indian companies are set to produce 8 less costly vaccines that are designed to fight COVID-19, including AstraZeneca's Covishield. Its developers call it the vaccine for the world. Barry O'Farrell is Australia's ambassador to India. O'Farrell, along with other diplomats, recently visited vaccine manufacturing areas in India. He said that only one country could meet the demands of citizens in every country, and that's India. Serum Institute of India, SII, is the world's biggest vaccine maker. It has already stored more than 50 million doses of the AstraZeneca shot. The shot still awaits emergency use approvals from both British and Indian officials. SII plans to make a total of 400 million doses of Covishield by July. It is setting up new production lines to make around 1 billion shots a year. Meanwhile, drug company Shotcasia is increasing production of vaccine vials. Vials are small glass or plastic containers for medicines. Deutsche Post's DHL, a delivery company, is working out the best way to send out the shots within the country and around the world. Because of the large volumes coming out of India, and of course the affordable vaccines, there is no other country that will contribute more towards ending the pandemic than India, SII CEO Adar Poonawalla told the Reuters news agency recently. Much of India's vaccine production could be, at least at first, for local use. With nearly 10 million infections, India has the world's second highest rate, following the United States with the highest. India's government is likely to order a large amount of the vaccines for its 1.3 billion people. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has not yet said exactly how much India will need, but his government has said some vaccines may be approved in the next few weeks. Poonawalla said he expects to sell hundreds of millions of doses at home. Nearly half of its production could go overseas, the company has said. India's Bharat Biotech has asked for emergency approval for its government-backed vaccine candidate. The company is in talks to sell its product to more than 10 countries in South America, Asia, and Eastern Europe. Russia, meanwhile, has signed deals with Indian companies that will make the country the production and export center for its Sputnik V vaccine. Many companies in India's vaccine supply industries are making investments without signed agreements. "We've taken a calculated risk," said Rishad Dadachanji, a director at Shotkesha. Shotkesha is increasing its yearly manufacturing ability to 1.5 billion vials by November. That is around 300 million more vials than it currently produces. I'm John Russell.
In some countries, there would not be any problem with art showing French revolutionaries replaced with cartoon cats and birds. But it may be a sensitive subject for Thailand's monarchy. For artist Yuri Kensaku, the country's political situation shapes her work. Protesters in Thailand are calling for reform of the monarchy and other changes. "People have started their political awakening," said Kensaku. The Bangkok Art Biennale is now showing her latest artwork. It combines the influences of her Thai background with her experience making art in La Rochelle, France. There, historical works of art showing times of revolution gave her the ideas she uses now. Talk of revolution is sensitive in Thailand. People loyal to the monarchy say that protesters are trying to bring down that system of government. Supporters of the king think protesters are calling for reforms to limit his powers. But the protest leaders say that is not their goal. The protesters want to remove Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha and establish a new constitution. Kensaku's parents are Thai and Japanese. She was born and raised in Bangkok. She said her work is not meant to be a message about the monarchy. "We must learn about the past to understand the present, but I'm not saying that we have to go that way necessarily," she said. Kensaku does not believe that reforms will end the Thai monarchy. In the middle of one large Kensaku work, a female body with the head of a chicken holds a flag of blue, white, and red. It is similar to Frenchman Eugene Delacroix's 1830 painting, "Liberty Leading the People." In Delacroix's work, a woman representing liberty holds the French flag high over bodies of fighters at her feet. The painting depicts France's July Revolution of 1830. Kensaku's piece is called Blue, Blanc, Rouge. It relates to both the French and Thai flags, which use the colors blue, white, and red. In France's flags, the colors represent freedom, equality, and friendship. In Thailand, they stand for monarchy, religion, and nation. Kensaku's other work at the Biennale is a sculpture titled Broken Victoria. It is modeled on the winged victory of Samothrace, an ancient piece at the Louvre Museum in Paris. Kensaku's work combines a winged female body with the head of a cat with green hair. The cat woman holds a revolutionary flag above her head. A white tie around its middle suggests a symbol of the Thai protests, Kensaku said. And the cat woman's wing is broken. She noted that protesters can get hurt. "In order to achieve victory, you have to fight for it, and it's not going to be easy," she said. I'm Jill Robbins.
School districts across the United States have reported the number of students failing classes has risen many times higher than usual numbers. English language learners, as well as disabled and poor students, are suffering the most. Eric Jesperson is principal of McNary High School in the state of Oregon. At his school, 38% of grades in late October were failing, compared with 8% in normal times. Educators see a number of reasons for the change. Students learning from home often miss assignments or school completely. Internet availability is limited or not effectively established, making it difficult to complete and upload assignments. And teachers who do not see their students in person have fewer ways to note who is falling behind. That is especially true with many students keeping their cameras off during online classes. The increase in failing grades has been seen in districts of all sizes around the country. At Jesperson School in the Salem-Keizer Public School District, hundreds of students at first had grade scores of 0.0%. This showed that students simply were not taking part in school at all. In New Mexico, more than 40% of middle and high school students were failing at least one class as of late October. In Houston, Texas, 42% of students received at least one F in the first grading period of the year. A grade of F is the lowest possible letter grade a student can receive in the United States. Nearly 40% of grades for high school students in St. Paul, Minnesota, were Fs. That is double the amount than seen in a usual year. Many schools have increased efforts to return to in-person learning. Other schools are changing their grading policies and giving students more time to complete assignments. Jesperson said his school began to see grades improve after bringing groups of 300 students into the building to receive support from teachers. However, that recently stopped because of the area's rising coronavirus cases. Advisory teams have increased contact with students. Teachers have been asked to temporarily stop assigning graded homework. And parents of Hispanic students were invited to learn how they can see their children's grades online. In Charleston, South Carolina, administrators and teachers are considering bringing back a grading system used in the spring. The system permitted instructors to give 50s instead of zeros to make it less harmful to students' grades, said 8th grade English teacher Jody Stallings. "I'm an English teacher, not a math teacher, but I've learned zeros are very, very devastating to an average," he said. Most of the failing grades Stallings gives out come from missing assignments, not assignments that were turned in with a lot of wrong answers. You talk to them later, and they say, "You know, I just didn't do it. I didn't know the answer, so I just didn't do it," he said. Stallings teaches most of his students in person and the rest online at the same time at Moultrie Middle School. He added, "When you have a kid in person, he's going to take the test. Even if he doesn't know anything, he has a chance." In Hatch, New Mexico, high school registrar Blanca Ramirez said her job has changed during the pandemic. Now she often serves as a translator and advisor to students and parents who speak only Spanish. In discussions with students, She asks them how they can have such low grades. Ramirez said she thinks many students are afraid to even begin their schoolwork. And so just making that phone call opens up that encouragement, and they start making a little bit more effort, she added. In some cases, the biggest difficulty for an English language learning student is simply getting the necessary classwork online. A few times this school year, Ramirez has had students meet her in the school parking lot so she can show them and their parents how to use the online system. Hatch High School reported 79% of students were failing at least one class during their first grading period of the year. That percentage has been reduced to 46% within a few months. School spokeswoman Audrey Bluehouse says that is because school has been made easier and students are now more engaged. Bluehouse says the number was high in part because the school added an eighth class to every student's schedule this fall. Now, teachers have been instructed to give less homework. They have been urged to find different ways of teaching. Grading has been changed from a 100-point system to a 50-point system, so that missed assignments with zeros do not hurt students as much.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1880, President Rutherford Hayes completed four successful years in the White House. He did not want to serve another term. Hayes was a Republican. His party had great hopes of electing another Republican in the election of 1880. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe report on that election.
Many Republicans wanted to nominate former President Ulysses Grant. Grant had been out of office 4 years. People seem to have forgotten the political problems that shook his administration. Other Republicans supported the powerful party leader, Senator James Blaine. A third candidate was John Sherman, the Secretary of the Treasury. The Republicans had great difficulty choosing among Grant, Blaine, and Sherman. At their national convention, Republican delegates voted again and again. None of the three men received a majority.
The delegates voted 10 times, 20 times, 30 times. Finally, on the 34th ballot, 17 of the delegates voted for a compromise candidate. He was James Garfield, a Republican leader in Congress. Soon, both Sherman and Blaine asked all of their delegates to vote for Garfield. The compromise candidate won the nomination. James Garfield offered the vice presidential nomination to Chester Arthur of New York. Arthur's honesty had been questioned when President Hayes removed him as collector of taxes for the port of New York. But a powerful party leader there supported him. So delegates gave Arthur the vice presidential nomination to strengthen party unity.
The Democratic Party chose for its presidential candidate a hero of the Civil War, General Winfield Scott Hancock of Pennsylvania. The election campaign of 1880 was not exciting. Democrats charged that Republicans were dishonest. Republicans charged that a Democrat in the White House would make the South too powerful. Many people at that time still hated the South for starting the Civil War. They wanted to keep Southern states weak. 9 million people voted in the election. James Garfield won. He got only 10,000 more popular votes than Winfield Scott Hancock, but he got a majority of votes in the Electoral College. Garfield won 214 electoral votes. Hancock got 155.
The new president was 49 years old. He had served in the House of Representatives for 17 years. He had been a teacher, a college president, and a general in the Union Army during the Civil War. James Garfield became president of the United States on March 4th, 1881. His choices for a cabinet immediately reopened the conflicts that had appeared during the party convention.
The Republican Party had two powerful leaders. One was Senator Roscoe Conkling. The other was Senator James Blaine. Garfield won Blaine's support by naming him Secretary of State. He lost Conkling's support by refusing to name one of Conkling's supporters Secretary of the Treasury. Garfield denied he had promised anything to Conkling. Then he made Conkling even angrier by appointing one of Conkling's political enemies collector of taxes for the Port of New York. That was the most important federal job in Conkling's home state. Conkling refused to accept the appointment. He began a struggle in the Senate to block it.
Conkling charged that President Garfield had failed to observe the policy of senatorial courtesy. Traditionally, the president does not fill federal jobs in a state until he discusses them with the senators from that state. This long-time policy gave senators firm control over local federal jobs. They were quick to attack any changes in the method. But many senators were angry at Conkling. They did not like the way he gave orders to everyone. They did not like the way he threatened his opponents. They did not want to support him on this issue.
After several weeks, it became clear that the Senate would approve President Garfield's choice for the tax collector's job. Conkling decided to resign in protest. He would ask the New York legislature to show its support by electing him again to the Senate. Before this could happen, something very unexpected took place. It happened in the train station in Washington, D.C., on July 2, 1881. A man ran up to President Garfield, pulled out a gun, and fired twice. One bullet cut Garfield's arm. The other went into his back.
The assassin was Charles Guiteau. When he fired the gun, he shouted that he supported Roscoe Conkling's political machine. Charles Guiteau was insane. He believed God had ordered him to kill the president. But the words he shouted caused many people to wonder if others might be involved. After all, the vice president, Chester Arthur, supported Roscoe Conkling too. If James Garfield died, Chester Arthur would become president. History has provided no evidence that Roscoe Conkling, Chester Arthur, or any other political leader had a part in the shooting. Guiteau is believed to have acted on his own. Yet the situation did cause a great deal of tension while the nation waited to see if Garfield would survive.
The president was carried to the White House. A doctor tried to remove the bullet from his back. He could not find it. Days passed. The president's condition changed from day to day. Doctors pushed their instruments into the wound as they continued to look for the bullet. The wound became infected. Garfield grew worse. Then he grew better. He asked to be taken to the seashore. 2 months later, the doctors warned the cabinet and Vice President Arthur that Garfield was dying. The end finally came on September 19, 1881. The president's body was taken back to Washington. Memorial services were held there. And then the body was taken to his home state of Ohio for burial.
Not until after Garfield's death did doctors find the bullet that killed him. It lay only a few centimeters from the wound. Tissue had grown around it. The bullet itself would not have killed the president. What killed him was the effort made by doctors to find the bullet. Their instruments had spread infection throughout his body. James Garfield had been president for 6 months. He was the second American president to be assassinated. The first, Abraham Lincoln, had been shot just 16 years before.
The man who shot James Garfield, Charles Guiteau, was tried by a court in Washington. He was found guilty of murder. Like those found guilty of plotting to kill Abraham Lincoln, he was hanged. Vice President Chester Arthur was in New York when he received news of President Garfield's death. He quickly sent for a judge to give him the oath of office as president. Arthur was in his early 50s. He would serve one term as leader of the United States.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.